I actually have two topics that I prepared. Basically, one is the essentially completed thesis work of John Corson, and the other is the ongoing thesis work of Gino Segre. And the optical conductivity story, the untold story, is also a very long story. And the experiment that's going on now is new, and I think it's very interesting, and the students are taking data as we speak, so it would be very valuable for us and me to present the preliminary results that we have, because we can get hopefully feedback from people here, and we can just call the guys on the phone and tell them what they should measure today. So I thought that'd be more dynamic. So let me talk a little bit about these newer set of experiments. So this set of experiments is new to us, but it's been an ongoing thing for quite some time in HITC. Almost from the beginning, people have been doing such experiments and learning things. But still, basically, we have no idea how to account for the phenomena that we see. So in this set of experiments, what one does is experiment where you have a probe beam and a pump beam. And typically, what you're hoping to do with the pump beam is to put in a high-energy electron-hole pair, which then is going to decay by a cascading process into a bunch of low-energy electron-hole pairs. Maybe it's not fair to say you hope that, but you would like to know what it does indeed do, and that's at least one thing it can do. And the most convenient way of finding out whether that's what's happening is with a probe beam. And what you do then with the probe is measure the change in reflectivity caused by absorption of the pump beam. And this is a nice experiment in the sense that you can do it on films and crystals. And we've begun to collaborate with Doug Bon and Liang and Hardy at UBC, looking at their crystals, for example. And typically what you see is something like this, where the reflectivity changes due to absorption of the pump, and then the change that you've created subsequently decays to zero on some time scale. And in our most recent data, this is actually something that we don't see. We see something more complicated. Now, when you do such an experiment, you might imagine that the results you see might have absolutely nothing to do with superconductivity, because you're pumping on a very high energy scale and you're probing on a very high energy scale, something like 30 to 50 times higher in energy than the gap, for example. So you can argue about whether you might see something, but however, it's experimentally known that you do see something that has to do with superconductivity.
So what color is the pump?
In this experiment, the pump and probe are both dull red. But one experiment that I was going to mention to you, this is a very interesting experiment. This is done by Robert Kindle and his collaborators, and Kindle is now a postdoc at LBL with Daniel Shemla. So he's continuing such experiments. In this experiment, the pump was in the visible, but the probe was in the far infrared. So the probe was actually at a frequency comparable to the gap, superconducting gap. This is YBCO films. This particular, they did optimal and underdoped. So this particular curve, set of curves, is for their optimal sample. And what you see is very dramatic here. These are the photo.
This pointer, if you want.
So this is the fractional reflectivity change versus time in picoseconds, and this is for different temperatures. You can see in this particular case, the dynamics are pretty independent of temperature. We just get the same characteristic recombination rate. But the very surprising thing is if you just look at the amplitude of this signal, you get something that looks like this, that it turns on right at TC. And the two symbols that are being overlapped here are the amplitude of the reflectivity change and the magnitude of the so-called 40 MeV resonance. So you're supposed to see from this that both of those characteristic features of high TC superconductivity, or this feature, turns on at the same way as that other feature that's consistent with coherence. Yeah, that's right. So from this set of experiments, we certainly learned that this signal, the appearance of this signal, has something to do with superconductivity. That's pretty unambiguous. But what it has to do with it...
So does it also follow order parameter, or is that very different? I mean, that's also...
Well, it seems to be, to me, to be flatter that... I don't know what... it seems to be flatter than the superfluid density, characteristically. Where I think we want to always see that with the neutron resonance, it doesn't have this characteristic linear regime. It seems to be more of a, almost of an BCS S-wave order parameter.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask, a few weeks ago, I spent a lot of time looking at persistent photoconductivity papers, like the DECA people. Is that totally orthogonal to this?
I don't know. I don't know.
There they see, they irradiate with visible light, and they see a persistent increase in the infrared reflectance that's just proportional to the dose, so it doesn't relax at all below room temperature because the charges are trapped.
Yeah. So here, you're looking, you're doing the same thing because you're shining light.
Yeah.
So here you're looking at that fraction of the population that recovers.
It's not going to get.
So this is the non-persistent component.
Right. Okay.
And I don't know, maybe they are related.
What are the units on the time axis?
These are picoseconds. Yeah.
That persists very long.
And the pulse itself is a really short pulse.
Yeah, the pulse is, the pulse is about 100 femtoseconds.
Okay. Yeah, so this is totally different.
So I think my interest in this is to try to understand what sort of excitations you create in a D-wave superconductor and what might be their dynamics. Ultimately, what I'd like to do is to create a lot of nodal quasiparticles that hang around for a long time and do some transport experiments on them. But before we get to that stage, we have to figure out what is going on in these types of experiments. And for S-wave superconductors, there's a pretty well understood picture of what should happen. The idea is that you create an electron hole pair with a very high energy. There's a very fast process where that initial electron hole pair relaxes through subsequent emission of more electron hole pairs to electron hole pairs at the gap edge energy. And there they represent a quasi-thermal distribution in the sense that they can cool or equilibrate among themselves to some characteristic temperature, but they can't go away very quickly at all because their recombination is bottlenecked. And the process that leads to that bottleneck is simply that in a conventional superconductor, this electron can recombine with this hole, but that process emits a high-energy phonon. And that phonon can then turn around and do the process in reverse. So all that process does for you is to set up a quasi-equilibrium between electrons and phonons. And ultimately, for this excited state to relax back to the ground state, those high-energy phonons have to degrade. So you're actually measuring some sort of process of degradation of high-energy phonons at the end of the day.
And the lifetime of that state is?
Well, that's going to depend, on anharmonicity and,
right.
I mean, there are certain scaling. Yeah, that's going to be a very long time.
This is also fast that other parameters don't relax self-consistently. Is that the picture?
It's so slow that this is limiting. In other words, near TC, in a gapless superconductor, you could be looking at order parameter dynamics, presumably. But the idea is that your quasiparticles at low temperature bottleneck your order parameter dynamics, so you end up with a very, very slow time. The other thing is that, the other feature of this is that the intrinsic recombination rate of electrons and holes should depend somehow on their density. So that ray, just by simple kinetic theory, should go up with density. However, what's observed is that the recombination or return to the ground state is essentially independent of density. And that fits in with this picture because, again, it's the bottleneck that you're seeing. Now, in D-wave superconductors, the situation can definitely be much more complicated and perhaps more interesting because you don't have just one kind of gap-edge quasiparticle. You have gap-edge quasiparticles, but at all different values of the energy gap. And so, broadly speaking, you have nodal quasiparticles and antinodal quasiparticles. And the story here with regard to bottleneck physics is much more interesting, I think, because in a sense you have a bottleneck. But the other thing, which was pointed out by Feenstra and Van der Merel, is that in this case, even your recombination into a phonon is also kinematically forbidden because the Fermi velocity at the node is far greater than the sound velocity. So it's completely unclear how this kind of a non-equilibrium distribution of nodal quasiparticles can relax back to the ground state. So I think there are a lot of interesting open questions. And we've begun to do this now. Since I said there's a lot of people have done this, basically the reason why we're in this game is that we have access to a couple of other kinds of materials to look at to see how universal things are. And what we found is that we're working towards seeing whether there's a consistent picture. But at this stage, I just want to present the data for an optimal BISCO film grown by Jim Eckstein at Urbana-Champaign and not overload you with too much data, especially if I go beyond this data set, I'm definitely getting into preliminary data that's just being taken, you know, right now. So this sort of is a picture of what we're seeing in BISCO. And you may say, well, what is this? There's a movie coming out, I think, about Jackson Pollock. It's not really splatter. So what we've done here to show you an overview is each one of these traces is one of these time traces. So that the time scale has been compressed in here. So this whole time scale is about 10 picoseconds. And then as I go down, I'm going down in temperature. And these are the temperatures here. So starting from 200 and then going down to 6 Kelvin over there. And then what are the different traces at each temperature? They represent different intensities of the pump beam. So what can we see just from this splatter picture here? First of all, we see that the signal it exists in the normal state, but it's clearly different. And it gets small near TC. There seems to be some opposite sign. I mean, there's different components going on in here. But then, you know, definitely in the neighborhood of the transition, we get something that comes up sort of like an order parameter, as you mentioned. The other thing that we focused a lot of our attention on, which I'll show you more clearly in a subsequent view graph, are two things. First of all, the recombination is getting much slower as I lower the temperature. So you can see in here, if I just look at the highest intensity curve, here's essentially time zero. And after the duration of the experiment, I've settled down to the value down here. Whereas if I go to low temperature, then I only go to there. So there's been a slowing down of the recombination. Furthermore, you can see that the trace is actually, well, it's a little hard to see from this, but what is happening is that the recombination is also getting slower as I lower the pump intensity. So that was the sort of the big picture. I can now slice it the two relevant ways. So this is this shows the data change in reflectivity versus time for a fixed pump intensity as I lower the temperature. And you can see it gets bigger and it gets slower. then I can also go to a fixed temperature, like a low temperature. And I can look at the reflectivity change as a function of time for different intensities. And in this case, they're normalized to unity here. So you can see very clearly that as I lower the pump intensity, the decay of the excited state becomes slower and slower.
Is that decay some power on
time? Yeah, we can fit this with a model which is has a monomolecular and bimolecular term in its rate equation. Okay. So it fits pretty well to that.
So you're saying it's not exponential? Or
it's definitely non-exponential, that's right. But then, so that actually leads into my next point, which is that to get a quick overview of what the decay is doing, because it is non-exponential, one thing that we've done is just look at the instantaneous decay rate at some initial time. So this is like, if it was a single exponential, that would be the exponential decay rate here. Since it's non-exponential, the instantaneous decay rate is changing and slowing. So I'm looking at the instantaneous decay rate at about a delay of 4 picoseconds. So we do that for all of the data. And that's shown here. So this is the initial decay rate versus excitation density for different temperatures. And what you see from this is what I've been telling you, which is that if I look at low temperatures like 5 Kelvin, the initial decay rate increases as I increase the pump intensity and the carrier density. And the increase is almost linear. Whereas if I say I look at low intensity and change the temperature, then I see a very rapid increase of decay rate with temperature. And one of the things we noticed was that at low intensity, this change in decay rate essentially goes as the temperature squared. So we have a situation where here it's going as temperature squared, and at low temperature versus density, it's linear. And this led us to attempt to scale this data in a sort of obvious way then. And to plot the data as a function of t squared plus the intensity of excited carriers. And there has to be a dimension-full coefficient here. And subsequently, I've recognized that this is not the cleanest way of plotting this. I told you this was sort of new. What we really should be plotting here is N thermal plus delta M. And this, in a D-wave superconductor, this goes as T squared. So in any case, this is what the experiment tells us, is that the decay rate is scaling as something like this with a coefficient here. It doesn't have to be, it would also scale if you plotted it versus, you know, max T squared plus N or something
so,
like that.
So are you saying that if you took N plus N thermal squared and had second order kinetics, then that would explain your linear term?
Right, well, not N plus N thermal squared, but N plus N thermal.
For dndt.
Yeah, dndt.
dndt yeah. Where N thermal plus delta N all squared.
Not squared. If dN by dt was delta N times N thermal plus N. Then I would get this, because this is going as T squared. So I would get this T squared here. I was just saying the rate, this is the rate, gamma, or little gamma. This rate is going as n thermal plus n. Plus delta n. Yeah, and this fits the entire time trace as well, because this gives you the non-exponential character, because this is going as minus delta n squared minus delta n times n thermal. So this process is a simple monomolecular single exponential. This term is a bimolecular type of term, which will give you your non-exponential kinetics. So I'm just saying that all I'm saying now is that this is the initial decay rate, but the subsequent decay also scales this way. So we could also put, you know, time on this axis, sort of. So then one is led to ask, you know, how can you get such a thing? And that's when we thought of this connection to the number of thermal quasiparticles. So this is, at this level of the game, this is sort of what we think may be happening. Okay, so I'll just go through this story and then you can poke holes in it. But we think that in the D-wave superconductor, we are thermalizing down until we fill the energy states just near the node. So we obtain a quasi-Fermi distribution with basically a quasi-Fermi level for electrons and a quasi-Fermi level for holes. I guess actually a quasi-Fermi level for quasi-holes. And then the separation between these two quasi-Fermi levels is going to scale with the photo-excited density or the temperature. And it depends which is bigger. So that if you're in the low photo-excited density limit, then this energy is going to go like the temperature. Okay, so that's if the photo-induced is much less than the thermally induced, then this separation is just kT. However, if you pump in more than the thermal density, then you're going to start filling this up. And because of this linear density of states, then E is going to go as the square root of N. So that says that this E star that I've defined this way is going like the maximum of T and N to the 1/2. And then if you were to assume that gamma just goes as E star squared, then you obtain this relationship for gamma as we see. So that's where we are now, and we are studying a bunch of other samples in which we tend to see similar effects, that is, we see these signals becoming larger as we go to lower temperature, and also we see that the recombination rate becomes slower as we go to lower pump intensity. Now, ultimately, what we'd like to be able to do is, if we can convince ourselves that we do create such a state, then we can obtain a gas of cold quasiparticles, but with very long lifetimes. So we can maintain this non-equilibrium state for very long times, essentially because of these various kinematic constraints and bottlenecks. And then we believe it might be possible to actually measure the diffusion of these quasiparticles in real space. And this would be interesting because the diffusion of the quasiparticles in real space is really a different quantity than we've been able to measure before. So for example, in the electrical transport measurements, you're measuring you think you're you're not really measuring the mean free path, or you're not really measuring the diffusion, because you're measuring the length scale over which momentum is lost. And that's different than the diffusion coefficient. So I think it would be a very fundamental interest to measure the actual diffusion coefficient of this gas and see if it extends over length scales of order microns, as one could perhaps is suggested by the transport measurement.
I mean, spatially resolving?
Yeah.
Pump and the probe?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Well, yeah.
What scale can you measure?
You can half a micron, mm-hmm. something like that. So maybe even a bit better. It depends on the diffusion rate compared to the decay rate. So the longer they live, the more of a chance you have to spatially measure their diffusion length. Okay. Any other questions on this?
So how long does it take the quasi-particles to thermalize to this effective distribution? And is it a short enough time scale from whatever processes?
Yeah, that's really it. I mean, that's a very good question, you know, both theoretically, experimentally, because we are seeing at low temperatures and low pump intensities, we are resolving rise times. See, all of the curves I showed you that we're more sure of or were taken a while ago, you know, the rise time is unresolved. You just see a decay. But in the newer experiments and other samples, we see rise times that on occasion can get very long. And people haven't reported this as yet. So it's something new, and we don't know why we're seeing that as opposed
very
to...
Very long
other.
Being long?
Yeah, right. Very long for us is longer than our particular experiment is set up to measure. So we typically go out to about 20 picoseconds. So we're seeing, you know, we're barely resolving the rise, so, you know, time scales on the order of tens of picoseconds, which is certainly long times. I mean, it's also quite fascinating that you just see nothing in the normal state. So you should still be creating an electron hole pair, which should still be cascading to many electron hole pairs, which then eventually have to recombine. And the fact that you see almost nothing suggests that this entire process is just very, very fast. And it's suggestive that what's happening, at least one of the things that's happening in the superconducting state, is developing this bottleneck both to reach the node and, once you're in the node, to go back to the true ground state. Mm-hmm. So I think both of those, both that thermalization and recombination time, are very, very interesting things to explore. Yeah?
I have a question. People are doing similar experiments in principle in semiconductors. So if I look at a semiconductor and would go to a single metal where I have a band overlap, but I have a Q spanning the minimum and maximum of the valence and conduction bands, it appears to me that at least in principle I get similar issues theoretically to this cause.
Yeah, in terms of the kinematic constraint. I mean, if you have like a point, Dirac point, essentially that same. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that those kinematic constraints. Yeah, in fact, I don't, you know, I'd like to learn. I don't know if there's any operational distinction between the recombination in which this pair jumps back into the condensate versus jumping back into the vacuum, as in a semiconductor. I mean, I don't know if that shows up in the, if there is going to be experimental manifestation of that difference. So this may well be very, very similar to the zero gap semiconductor. Okay, so I wanted to show you which is something we're doing right now. Now, So I have to warn you, I have this long lecture in front of me. Now, I know it's lunchtime, so I want to sort of, if you want to ask questions or guide me by what you're interested in, I certainly don't want to go on over long. But I think there are a lot of points of optical, and the optical conductivity is an enormous area. And there are a lot of issues, so I thought maybe I'd just start talking and try to go quickly so I wouldn't bore anyone and be guided by some of the things that you might be interested in. So, overview and open questions. Well, what I mean by this diagram here is that the reason we initially started measuring optical conductivity was the hope that we were going to learn something about high TC. And it's essentially, it's still an open question about whether we're learning anything about high TC, because the phenomenology of sigma of omega is so complicated and rich, it's either rich or complicated, that it's enough of a hard job to try to get a self-consistent phenomenology of sigma of omega so that we can then infer, you know, just all agree on what we may or may not be learning about the material. And so this has been, you know, something that I've been worrying about. So why is this true? Well, these are some of the difficulties, I think, that have given rise to this, to these issues. The most important and the most fundamental is that conductivity is clearly looking at a Fermi surface average. And therefore, there is very much of a weakness compared to momentum-resolved probes. In addition, there are multiple components in the conductivity that can be very difficult to separate. Essentially, this is one of the points here. You can view this as already multiple components coming from different parts of the Fermi surface. In addition, you have, certainly in the superconducting state, you have contributions from the quasiparticles and the condensate, and there may even be other modes and other contributions to the conductivity. This is sort of, we know these two must be there in the superconducting state. And of course, the usual issues with samples are lead to always very profound problems. And another problem that I think I emphasize, because I think it's true, is that there is a problem with the data set, that in the critical frequency regime, where the frequency is on the order of TC, that does still correspond to a frequency window in which it is difficult to take reliable data. So as if we didn't have enough to worry about, we still have a technical issue that confronts us. So with all these issues, you might say, why bother? And the reason is that certainly the conductivity can tell us in principle some very, very fundamental things. Perhaps the most fundamental is this issue of spectral weight. There's an F-sum rule on the conductivity, and one of the most profound and important aspects of cuprate physics is how this spectral weight varies as we vary the carrier concentration. Then, of course, in principle, if we understand all of this, then the conductivity is the current fluctuation spectrum of these modes and gives us the characteristic time scales of the problem. So that would be nice. And finally, going along with my theme that this is a complex problem, you could turn it around and say that with all of this discussion of what does it mean to actually solve the high TC problem, one ultimate test for a truly microscopic model would be that this model should in principle be capable of turning this back and calculating the conductivity from some understanding of these materials, and that would be a real achievement. Okay. So now on to the dirty work. The preliminary in this business is that you can, of course, stick to only plotting conductivity. But there's a very popular, and to some extent justifiably so, parameterization of the conductivity in terms of a generalized Drude model that I think most of you are familiar with. In terms of frequency-dependent renormalized mass and a frequency-dependent renormalized time scale. And from, if you know the real and imaginary parts of the conductivity, you can immediately just do some algebra and get the time scale or the renormalized rate, just the omega times the ratio of sigma 1 to sigma 2. And one of the things that I have to smoothly connect to the fact that I've presented this view graph slightly out of order. Okay, so anyway, this is, hold that thought. So, not very.
Question, what's that n supposed to be in the way in which you define the n star and those stars?
Yeah.
What n do you take?
What n?
Yeah.
Well, n is not an this type of experiment can never untangle n and m. So you can view this as, if I called, I should take n over m and call that a primitive quantity, and I never disentangle them in this type of experiment.
Just think of it as omega p squared.
But, no.
And what it is. Yeah.
Okay, so what I meant to go to next, well, I'm really going to cringe if I ever have to listen to this recording. God. Okay, so I meant first to discuss the optimal carrier concentration, in which the phenomenology in the normal state for transport is very simple to write and nearly impossible to understand. Rho goes like T. And these are some phenomenological viewpoints that have been constructed to try to understand this. One thing that we hear a lot about is the quantum critical aspect of this, where the conductivity in the critical regime would have some sort of scaling property. So it would look like this. Another thing that I'm going to talk a bit about, actually, is the marginal Fermi liquid phenomenology, in which it's not the conductivity, but rather the self-energy that has this scaling. And this gives rise to an experimental difference. And I'd like to understand from some people in the audience whether this is meaningful or not. Then there's the nearly anti-ferromagnetic Fermi liquid, where 1 over tau goes like T squared, as in a Fermi liquid, but we have hot quasi-particles that have renormalized Fermi energy that are very, very small, and that these hot quasi-particles carry most of the current, and at finite temperatures above EF star, we see some very funny properties. And also a very clever idea from Yaffa and Millis that 1 over tau near the pi-pi point, pi-pi direction, goes like T squared plus an angle-dependent constant. And in this case, it's similar to this picture in that 1 over tau goes like T squared, but it's different in that, in this case, it's the cold quasi-particles that carry most of the current. Now, I would maintain one of my first themes in this, what could be a lecture series here with the view graphs I have, but don't, you know, is to test these ideas with a combination of ARPES and conductivity. If we're going to look at the conductivity, it's inevitable that we would tend to look at ARPES and try to be informed by some momentum-dependent probe. Otherwise, we're going to have a lot of trouble with the conductivity taken alone. Okay, so then my point was going to be that one can look at the 1 over tau star, and one can distinguish these models because they actually do make different predictions for this quantity, especially in the DC limit. Okay, so I'm going to take the DC limit, low frequency limit of this ratio. And from my understanding, in the quantum critical theories, predict that this quantity goes as T. The Yaffa-Millis, they predict that this quantity goes as T squared. And in the marginal Fermi liquid, this quantity goes like T with a logarithmic term. And initially in our data, we thought we were seeing T squared. But it turned out that that data was incorrectly interpreted. This is also going out worldwide. And now we believe that we're seeing something very accurately described by this logarithmic correction. And that's why I'm so interested in whether there's a distinction between this prediction t and this prediction t log t, because the experiments clearly are telling us that there is this correction. Okay, so then we use a spectrometer with a block diagram to measure this, so I'll spare us that. And this is what we're actually measuring, just to orient you on this. So we're in the low frequency limit. So the real part of the conductivity is looking like something very flat. Okay, we're not really getting to the parabolic downturn very much. But we can pick up directly the imaginary part with our technique. And the imaginary part is just growing linearly. So that when we look at the ratio in this regime of sigma 2 to sigma 1, we get these kind of data. And this is for different temperatures where I'm going lower in temperature. So, and this is how we know whether we're in the normal state or the superconducting state by this experiment. So in the normal state, we see that this ratio is linear in the frequency. So therefore, its slope is a direct measurement of tau star. So that's what we see in the normal state. And then as we cross into the superconducting state, this is what happens. And deep into the superconducting state, then here we're just being dominated by sigma 2. So sigma 2 is going like superfluid density over omega. So as we go from the normal state to the superconducting state, we're crossing over to where this quantity goes linear in omega to 1 over omega. And this point here is actually the critical point where this is independent of frequency. Okay, so what I'm going to show you now is just this slope, how that slope changes with temperature.
Excuse me, at the finite frequency, will N or M star have any imaginary part?
At finite frequency, will what?
N over M star.
N over M star?
Does it contain any imaginary part?
No, that parameterization is set up so that those are both real functions. It's like, they're not quite a Kramers-Kronig pair, but you can define a Kramers-Kronig pair.
So what is the critical temperature that corresponds to the flat line? Is that in the usual BCS, is that the superconducting temperature, is the transition temperature, or?
Well, so in BCS, I'm not sure BCS captures, Steve Gerfen is here, so, I mean, this would be the critical, like in a, you know.
Well, what's the critical thing to that temperature, I guess, where I'm asking?
That should be TC.
I just don't know if BCS captures this, or you have to go to a critical, beyond mean field to maybe capture this.
Isn't TC where the omega, the acoustic part disappears? You have an offset for the first one?
But I guess this is going. Yeah. So this, if we go one lower, that would do that or something.
Is this for optimally doped sample?
Well, this is schematic.
Yeah, suppose
you would see this for every sample.
Well, even amidoped.
Yeah.
So it's, you see the red line only at TC, but not somewhere between T star and TC.
Right. We see this at low at temperatures near TC. We certainly don't see anything. That's a good question. We don't see any anomalies near T star to our resolution in this transport.
So it's mainly sensitive to the autoplanar, not the gap.
What?
I mean, it's sensitive to the autoplanar, not the.
Yeah, or the superfluid density, not the gap. Yeah. So.
So Kramers-Kronig tells us that if it's flat, it's a power. Each one is a power law.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Right. So there. Yeah, it's a pure power law at the critical with no rollover.
Sure. I'm sorry. There's still one thing I don't understand about this plot. If you extrapolate the high temperature normal state curves, they are supposed to extrapolate to zero, correct? These straight lines.
Yeah.
There.
Right.
And then there must be somewhere a transition where all of a sudden you do not go down to zero anymore in the limit of zero frequency. Right,
and then I suppose I should be immediately here, because I guess.
So there's a jump.
No, there's no jump. I mean, there's got to be some scaling. you know, where this gets steeper, I mean.
I guess just meaning you need to draw more lines.
Okay, I mean, this is sort of just, anyway, this is my point for now anyway, the normal state of things. So what I want to do is plot the, so this is a plot of the measured, this is for an optimal sample, and this is the measured tau star, and this should say femtoseconds here. So the data is somewhat noisy, so that is granted, because these timescales are very short. They're difficult for us to measure. The phase shifts we're measuring are very small. So there is noise in the data, but on the other hand, there are no systematic errors that we believe in the data. So this is really a picture of tau star. And those are femtoseconds, and I'm going to plot it in a variety of other ways that make more sense. Here's a couple of plots that I think are reasonable ways to look at these data. This is a plot of tau star normalized to h bar over kt. So this is a dimensionless number, and this is a real number. I mean, this is the number. And so I would contend that if tau star was simply, you know, 1 over the temperature, you would get a flat line at unity. So you see that it's significantly smaller, and also there is a temperature dependence to this quantity. And the data looks prettier if you make a plot of tau in femtoseconds versus t to the 1.5. And then you can see that it is a very good fit to t to the 1.5. And then this is a plot on the same axis of h bar over kt. And you can see again that tau is much shorter, significantly shorter than h bar over kt. And it has a temperature dependence that's distinct from linear.
Is it the same data?
Yeah.
Why does it look noisier to the right?
Because I think the reason is that it's all, that's what my advisor taught me about physics, was that everything depends on how you plot it. So here, I've taken out the strong temperature dependence, 1 over t, and shown only the log correction. So when I show you just I'm calling it a log correction. So when I look at just the log correction and blow up the scale, you can see all the noise. But here, I'm sort of doing the opposite and focusing on the full t to the 1.5, and it just, everything depends on how you plot it.
What is TC?
TC is like 86 or something.
This is all
normal state. Yeah.
Normal
state, yeah.
Okay.
This label vertical axis on the left.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, 1 over tau.
1 over tau. Right.
No, well, maybe, yes, a little bit maybe.
That explains.
So, oh, that was your I'm sorry. I gave you a whole lecture on the, sorry. I thought you meant why this looks much cleaner.
Well, that's noisy to the right,
yeah.
But because you to the left, you multiply it by the temperature.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Could you back up to the sigma 2 over sigma 1?
Yeah.
You think you know the way I should have drawn it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I think it looks more critical at high frequencies than low frequencies, so that intermediate guy's
curving the wrong way.
In other words,
The slope gets steeper.
It should go flat and then drop off.
Because tau star,
right,
going infinity as you approach.
Yeah, I think what I'm doing here is, my mind was triggered by what the data actually does look like, which is complicated by the fact that it's not really dominated purely by the order parameter, but you're getting in our spectral range, you're getting a ton of quasi-particle conductivity as well. So this represents what it looked like to me on the page.
What's the temperature scale? I mean, the curves above and below TC, how much above and below it? 10 Kelvin, 20 Kelvin?
Yeah, we see the fluctuation peak that's about 5 to 10 Kelvin.
That's
in our disco samples.
Here,
now, I haven't really gone into that. I mean, this is much.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, now what I wanted to show you is uncharacteristically, I suppose, talk about someone else's experiment. because what I want to show is that the same parameters that you would extract from this marginal Fermi-liquid phenomenology not only work in this DC regime, but they predict, they really give a beautiful description of the data in the infrared regime where the frequency is bigger than the temperature and less than about 100 times the temperature. So this is the formula that that Elihu Abrahams and Chandra Varma used to calculate a conductivity based on their marginal Fermi liquid ansatz for the self energy. So as I understand it, I'm sure it will mean more to you than to me, but I think this is the Kubo formula ignoring vertex corrections. I always wanted to say something like that. And take this formula then and compare this with the conductivity obtained in this frequency range from Kramers-Kronig analysis of the reflectivity. And the other thing is, as I say, I'm going to be sort of informed, to use that cliche, by something that we believe we know about the Fermi surface average from ARPES spectroscopy, that the scattering rate is anisotropic, and that there's a change in scattering as one moves along this line. Yes?
Yeah, since you mentioned vertex corrections, why would you why would you begin comparing ARPES with a transport measurement? ARPES is measuring a single particle Green function, and transport measurement is dominant. I mean, in the cases of which, I mean, I've looked at it.
But that answers your own question, right? You're saying one involves vertex corrections and the other doesn't.
So I should look at the two,
and if they're different, very different, I know that vertex corrections are very important. And if they're the same, then they're not. And I can make that statement without even knowing what they are. Which just shows how powerful this argument is. Okay. So, so this is the ARPES data of Brookhaven Group. And in these data, what they've done is they've used their innovation of measuring the so-called MDC, the momentum distribution curve, to infer mean free paths as a function of the temperature. And these data sets correspond to different cuts through the Fermi surface. And this is the pi-pi direction, and this is the pi-zero direction. So, you know, I don't want to, I mean, the I don't know if it's, you know, I mean, obviously, some of these, but still, you can you could try a model in which Abrahams and Chandra have considered, in which the slope is the same and the only difference is the extrapolation to zero temperature, and that that's what's changing in these dynamics as you move along the Fermi surface. Now, I know the EDCs are very different and there's a lot of rich physics in that, so I just want to try attempt this model, though. And so what I want to do is just make a two-component model for the conductivity, where in this region I have marginal Fermi-liquid quasi-particles, and here I have marginal Fermi-liquid quasi-particles with some zero-temperature intercept. And I basically want to use these, be guided by the ARPES data in the in this value of the intercept and these values of lambda. The data set that I want to use is, I think, a very beautiful set of data from Manuel Quijada when he worked in David Tanner's group. And the reason I'm picking out this data is because this is on BISCO, so at least one is comparing the same compound in ARPES and transport, and our measurements of the low frequency limit are also on BISCO. So we're looking at the same compound here. And I plotted these data on that were kindly sent to me by Manuel on log-log plot. And you can see this behavior very, very beautifully, how there's a power law at high frequency and then a cutoff, characteristic cutoff frequency, and it approaches a DC limit.
Do two samples have the same TC?
Yeah, yeah, they do. They do. All of these samples are maybe not the highest TC you can make. All of these samples in our work and the Brookhaven work and this Quijada thing are in the high 80s. So what I found was that this kind of model with these two contributions, both with this marginal Fermi liquid self-energy, gives a very good description of the data. What I did was to add the hot and cold contributions with about equal spectral weight. And then this is the kind of decomposition that I had, where you have this cold contribution here and the hot contribution, not, I don't know if hot is a good term anymore. I don't think it is a good term, but this part has a larger elastic contribution. And they both give a very good fit to the high frequency power law, as you'll see. So this high frequency power law, which is about omega, 1 over omega to the 0.6, is really uniquely the power law you get from something where there's a 1 over omega and the logarithmic correction that they have. So there is no adjustable parameter. You're not putting in this exponent by hand. It's really coming from this logarithmic correction.
Can we just go back to the original paper that you the Tanner paper?
Yeah.
They actually tried a marginal Fermi liquid fit themselves.
Yes.
Right, without the cold spot relaxation rate.
Right.
Constant relaxation rate. And they concluded it didn't fit well over the whole range.
Right.
So we're focusing now on this extra constant, your patch near the antinode to make the difference. Is that right?
That's one potential difference. I'm not sure also whether it matters whether you integrate this full form. They used there's a approximation scheme that Abrahams and Varma suggested quite a while ago. For that integral does reduce to a simple form, you know, in certain limits. And that approximation equation was also used extensively. I'm not sure if that might make some difference. And that's the other possible difference. But it's also possibly, I haven't verified it. It may be that this broad contribution that you see has, you know, very small, it's a very small contribution. But that may be what makes the changes. But this is why I wanted to discuss this, because there is a question of how well this model fits. And this is the kind of things that I obtained. So this is a marginal Fermi liquid fit to the conductivity. The parameters are, I just added these two contributions. Now, it turns out that in the marginal Fermi liquid theory, the way it's written, there are supposedly two parameters, a cutoff and a coupling constant. It turns out for all properties sort of at fairly low energies, there's really only one parameter. And that's something that a graduate student named Chris Weber discovered working on this fitting. So I think it's a very, I could show it's not worth going through here, but I think it's a very interesting thing that theory really only has one parameter for low energy properties. Okay, and this is the elastic coefficient. So for the nodal particles, zero, and then 10th of an EV, which is very consistent with what is suggested by ARPES. So there's one set of parameters, which is a very minimal set of parameters, and then you just change the temperature. And this is the room temperature fit, and this is 150. And then if you go to then if you go to 100, this is what you get. And there is a deviation here. But one could argue that this is indeed, you're very sensitively seeing the pseudo-gap deviation that we know becomes strong as we go to underdoping. So I would maintain that this is also another really excellent fit. So over the available temperature range of the normal state, this parameterization is a very good phenomenological description of the data. Now, to go beyond that, the next thing that I did was I calculated the spectral function. I calculated what you would see if you did an EDC in the nodal direction in ARPES using the same parameters that I inferred from transport. So this is exactly your question, I think. So this is what you would expect to see if you measure the EDC as a function of energy for different momenta. And then I took the half width of this and compared with what's quoted in ARPES. So these are the half widths that I obtained from these curves. Okay, this is in millielectron volts. And this is the most recent data. I'm just quoting this because this is a very recent data set from a group working at the Advanced Light Source, ZX Shen, Zahid Hussain, and their collaborators. And they get something that looks very linear within the noise, and then their quoted noise is very small. And this is their plot, this is their data, compared quantitatively with this set of data. So what I take from this is that, first of all, they lie on the same chart. I mean, they're very comparable. But their line widths and the low energy limit are significantly broader. In fact, this doesn't take into account that there should be another factor of two from looking at single particle and two particle properties. So the line width from transport near the Fermi level is about a factor of four smaller than you might expect. So that represents the level of comparison we are right now, I think, between transport and photo emission.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
You should be measuring the Unklopp scattering rate. Correct?
Yeah, so right. So there are many, yes, right.
That's yeah. Some factor of
yeah, so you
of
could, that's right.
One,
right.
Yeah, two, yeah. In fact, we need right. Some calculations. We find
so it's perfectly reasonable that this gapping could be larger than that, yeah. So that's, again, my point is that this all is a very consistent phenomenology. But it, to me, and this is another thing I was hoping to get maybe some feedback on.
Sorry, could you just put up the EDC that you sort of backed out once again? Transport?
Yeah.
Scale.
And the scale is binding energy.
Doped or slightly underdoped your samples, or
these are all optimally doped samples. So this is the spectral function times the Fermi function to just try to simulate the data.
Well, it's much sharper just to the eye than what's actually seen in ARPA, isn't it? I mean,
that's right, and that's
the use effect of four.
Four. I think that's it. I don't think it's much sharper than a fact. I think it is a factor of four. I mean, this one is very sharp here because that's being cut off by the
behind the background, though. I mean,
right, exactly. So that's the other big bugaboo, and that's why, I mean, this once you get to larger binding energy, this width is extremely sensitive to background. Hmm. So there is a potential systematic problem in the, and that's why it. And that's why you should either look at the MDCs, as they've suggested, or do a theory that gives you these line shapes and also understand what is background. Yeah. So background is a big problem in the experiment.
So you haven't done that MDC?
The MDCs are going to agree very well. In fact, I think I forced them to agree. I mean, I think that was one of the starting points, was that I could make them agree by my choice of lambda, or that's not quite right. I think the agreement is pretty good in the MDC.
So the procedure was to take the slope in attention dependence of the damping rate to be the same as in MDC and use the gamma, the residual value to be the different parameter, and that comes out to be not the same as the more extrapolated.
No, I don't think I know. I'm not sure I followed what you said there.
In MDC, there's a slope self-energy.
As a function of
temperature.
Right, right.
And then there's also residual values.
Right, right. I'm not sure that I used that slope. I think what I actually did, and I'm not sure whether it's equivalent, was I took the optical data and then made a best fit to the of that data to this to the marginal Fermi liquid phenomenology, and just took that data and compared with the EDC. So I'm not quite sure what it gives you for the MDC versus temperature, but I'm not remembering exactly what I did.
But let me just make sure I understand what you've done. I mean, you've taken the best fit of marginal Fermi liquid theory with no vertex corrections to your connectivity data.
Their data, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and then just pulled out the self-energy, I mean, the ARPAS.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. So it seems to me there's more smearing of the single particle than even in marginal Fermi liquid. That would be sort of relative to what you would expect coming from the conductivity.
Well, I think you could perhaps, from relative to the conductivity, you could look at the ARPAS data in isolation and I think perhaps get a very good fit with a different set of parameters. So, I don't think you can fit them in their current form, you know, with a single set of parameters.
But if you then went back and tried to fit the optical connectivity with those parameters, and do the reverse thing, how would you do it?
Yeah, I think it wouldn't work. I mean, I think there's certainly at the low. I mean, just look at the numbers here.
So vertex corrections are important, even assuming you have.
Well, of course, but I think that I think if the ARPA, you know, I guess I've talked about vertex corrections. Now I'm talking about ARPAS. So two things that I probably shouldn't be talking about. I think that also the ARPAS experimentalists get pretty nervous about the line width close to the Fermi energy. Because first of all, of course, you have the Fermi cutoff, which really, you know, I mean, makes things a little more complicated. And then resolution issues, and I was hearing also about tiny, tiny warpages in the sample, changing your momentum a little bit. I mean, you know, we don't know. I mean, these guys are really pushing the frontier. So maybe we really don't know exactly what the resolution limit is, you know, because it's a fuzzy concept when you're really pushing it, right? So, but I'm just saying that if I look at these numbers here, I mean, this number here, okay, is like 20 millivolts. So this is like almost room temperature. And we're at, you know, this is right at TC. So we're getting numbers here that are clearly much, much higher than the temperature. You know, by a factor of 2 or 3 higher than the temperature. So these have got to be too big to be consistent with the transport number. So the transport number is coming in down here, right about the temperature, as it should. Okay, but in my view, what I'd like to understand is the following. One of the things I thought I understood was that this picture of the kinematics suggested that if antiferromagnetism is important, and that's one of the things creating anomalous scattering, that we were led to a picture where the carriers that interacted strongly with the antiferromagnetic fluctuations were in these pi zero regions of the zone. And now what we're discovering is that these particles are carrying the bulk of the current in the normal state, and these have marginal, critical, whatever kind of anomalous name you want to put. These are the guys that have this funny scattering, as well as these have even funnier scattering, but these guys are not behaving in a way we understand. So essentially what we're learning is there are no cold quasi-particles. So I think this is, as I understand, a real challenge to theory to be able to understand what gives rise to the strong scattering of these particles in this region of the zone, and why it's essentially the same or similar everywhere in the Brillouin zone. Catherine, do you, and how, is it time for nap and milk and cookies and...
You say that there's no well-defined quasi-particles there, but you know, there's, you know, the thermal transport.
No, and the super, this is all in the normal state. Yeah, in fact, that's exactly my point. So I could drone on because, you know, the point is that the superconductivity is exactly the recovery of the coherence of these particles. And
I think I missed the logic somewhere in the middle. Could you very briefly summarize how you came to this conclusion?
I mean, I think that it's an existent, maybe an existence proof rather than something that one can be led to step by step. I mean, I started by using something that was suggested by the ARPES. And then I wanted to see whether, if I took that literally and didn't worry about vertex corrections, if the same self-energy that one would infer from those data is consistent with transport. And I found sort of a mixed answer where indeed the marginal Fermi liquid theory with two contributions does provide a really compelling fit to the transport. But the parameters, if then you work back, those parameters are not in precise agreement with ARPES, but differ by not factors of 10, 100, 1,000. They differ by, you know, 2, 3, 4. And as Peter pointed out, you know, there are many, you know, kinematic type of reasons why ARPES could give you broader line shapes than transport, since one is a momentum relaxation rate and the other is presumably measuring just the lifetime of that K state, independent of how much it's scattered. So that's sort of the logic. I mean,
but if you just go below TC just a little bit, I mean, yeah. 10 Kelvin below TC, at least near the pi zero point of the ARPES, then you get this coherent peak kind of coming up out of the background.
At the pi zero, yeah.
Pi zero.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, is there such dramatic change in the connectivity, or does that...
I have exactly this plot, and I prepared to talk about it. So this is in bonus time or something. I mean, I don't want anybody to feel they... I won't be insulted as people go and do something different, but that's what was coming next, essentially, was what happens in the superconducting state.
Or in particular, as you go into it.
Yes, just into it, yeah.
Just into it.
Okay, so...
I'm sorry, Joe, before you go on to the superconducting state, can I just follow up the normal state? The model that you took, it's essentially the same one proposed by Andy Lewis and you all, right?
No.
As far as the gamma at the antinode is concerned,
right,
and an angular dependence around the Fermi surface,
an angular dependent,
right,
elastic rate,
right,
right.
And now, if you took the numbers that you determined for that thing and compared with what they wanted in their paper, are those drastically different?
The
big elastic part.
The big elastic part is a little tricky in there now, because that big elastic thing only, I think, comes mainly into the overall spectral weight. But I mean, we can look at the, I mean, unfortunately, because I was a big fan of what they were trying to say, you know, it seems to be ruled out by, I mean, they're predicting that the 1 over tau along the node goes like t squared.
Yeah.
And these data show it goes like t. So unfortunately, because it's very compelling, it's a beautiful explanation of the Hall anomaly, but it seems at the present moment, and again, I wish I wasn't being taped, but at this moment in time, it seems to be being ruled out by the ARPES data.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just trying to get a sense of the gamma.
Sensitive to the gamma, their whole thing. I think gamma comes in as a prefactor when you do the integrals, because you're only looking at the node, and gamma is just sort of a cutoff then.
Yeah. A similar question. So, independent of ARPES, can one say from the optical data that a T-square dependence along a nodal direction is simply incompatible with the data?
That's a good question. So, So initially, we thought we'd verified what they saw, but yeah, the best way of looking at that is, in fact, this tau, where I started, this 1 over tau star. Now, they predict this in their model is exactly t squared. And it's a very subtle thing, and this looks like 1.5. So they would predict t squared. So that's to the extent to which the conductivity alone disagrees. Now, to get, if you plot something from a 300 Kelvin to 100 Kelvin, and you have noisy data, and you're trying to distinguish between t squared and t 1.5, it's pretty easy to screw that up. So the optical conductivity argues against that. The ARPES, you know, I think, argues more strongly against that. Is that, no?
This is from your data. This
yes.
Is not from the
optical. Oh. The reflectivity. The reflectivity, that was what was so clever and pretty about their model, is that once you get above frequencies of order tau star, yeah, it provides a beautiful description. Well, they predict exactly 1 over omega to the 1 half. So it's experimentally is closer to 0.6. So yeah, over higher frequency, the data I showed you from Quijada, you get quite a nice, maybe not quite as nice as the marginal Fermi liquid, but then that may have more parameters. So it's a pretty good explanation of the data in that frequency regime. That's why they had, that they were aware of all that data. That's why they came up with this. I mean, not why, but that's, anyway.
I didn't get where did you use the anti-ferromagnetic hotspot in your derivation? You just look at the nodal quasi-particle, but you never used any special scattering rate for the hotspot.
I did. I did put in a contribution from the hotspot as well, and that improves the fit quite a lot.
Okay, I missed that.
Okay. Well, it was a marginal Fermi liquid plus an elastic constant.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I wanted to discuss some issues involving what is the nodal quasi-particle lifetime versus temperature below the transition temperature, and again, this issue of ARPES. This is another hobby horse of mine. This is a controversy I've been having with Tom Timisk. What I'd like to, I think, a very important point, I mean, I learned a tremendous amount from him, but he's refusing to learn from me. And
hear that, Tom?
And so the point I want to make is you want to understand this quasi-particle scattering rate below TC. Now, I would contend you can no longer have this nice, simple procedure of looking at omega sigma 1 over sigma 2, that now it's not equal to 1 over tau star. And a lot of people are plotting this and also comparing with ARPES, and I think that this is something that we should not do. Because what is happening in the when you go below TC is that sigma 2, more so as you go to low frequencies, but always in the low frequency limit, it is dominated by the condensate contribution, rho s over omega. The fundamental reason you shouldn't do this is there are two components, condensate and quasi-particles. You're trying to learn the quasi-particle scattering rate, but you're mixing in contributions to the conductivity from the condensate. Sigma 2 goes like rho s over omega. So therefore, if you're at high energies, where they are, if you plot omega sigma 1 over sigma 2, it's just sigma 1 omega squared over rho s. So this quantity is such that it always goes to 0 in the superconducting state as omega goes to 0, like omega squared, and that's sort of what the data looks like. So this quantity obviously does not extrapolate to the quasi-particle conductivity, to the quasi-particle scattering rate. It extrapolates to 0. So Tom and his collaborators measure the optical properties of exactly the same crystals that Doug Bond and Walter Hardy are measuring. And they have some quasi-particle conductivity. And when Doug and Walter analyze their data with Druda fits, they will get a certain quasi-particle lifetime. And that quasi-particle lifetime is not what this thing will extrapolate to. So this is a different quantity.
And Joe, let me just, when Tom does that, is he doing it for C-axis stuff?
No.
No. For AB plane?
Yes. So what I would contend you have to do to analyze these data properly is you have to forget about sigma 2. Because you can't, this contribution is too big to measure and subtract off. You don't know this well enough. You're subtracting a very large contribution, a dominant contribution, the sigma 2. So you just can't do this. So you have to use something like a Drude fit to the line shape of sigma 1.
Can you do it if you're at very high frequencies? I mean,
yeah, if you go to high enough frequency, if you have a sigma, I mean,
because it's like the Sitter gap scale that I was talking about, right?
Right. So, well, okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, so if I have in the superconducting state, we know that at intermediate temperatures, I have a conductivity that's a delta function here. Then I have a quasi-particle contribution that in YBCO certainly is very narrow. And then I have some gap-like feature that's, you know, is roughly at 50 millivolts. And you're asking me, you know,
yeah,
about this regime.
Right.
So clearly, there will be a regime. Sigma 2 from this stuff is very small. But this sigma 2 from the condensate is dying. So there will be a frequency above which sigma 2 will be dominated by this. And then at least you're looking at sigma 1 over sigma 2 over of this contribution.
Right.
Now, inasmuch as this contribution is some finite frequency peak, mm-hmm, I don't know anymore what the generalized Drude model. So I will grant you that this ratio makes some sense, since you're looking at, you know what component you're looking at. But I don't know if it's the lifetime of anything.
Right. But he would never try to extrapolate that to low frequencies and get the 1 over tall of the Hardy and or
well,
numbers, right?
I don't know. He hasn't said where he.
I think it's on that scale. I mean, I think that the 1 over tall that he plots is a very large scattering rate.
Yeah, it is a large scattering rate.
It's not something that you could go down and try to extrapolate to 0.
Okay, you know, I would. Okay. I don't think that most. I mean, this curve is now, I've seen in Physical Review letters in an ARPES paper where it's compared to the ARPES line shape. And I don't think there are any caveats about how close, how low in energy I'm supposed to believe this. Whenever this is looking like omega squared, I'd be pretty worried. Okay, now let me say what happens generally. I think this is related to Matthew's question about what happens when you cross into the superconducting state, to the conductivity. And this is something we know a lot about, especially from some really beautiful work that Zach Schlesinger did quite a while ago, where he very carefully looked at the conductivity through the transition in untwinned crystals. So what I've sketched here is the conductivity as a function of frequency. And this is just above, you know, at TC, and this is like 10 degrees below, which was sort of your question. And I've sketched over here the superfluid density versus TC. This is sort of what the UBC data looks like on YBCO. And just to point out how rapidly the superfluid density rises. If you look, it's risen to about 40% of its total value within 10 degrees of the transition. So what happens to the conductivity line shape is pretty complicated just below TC. But the way I view this is that at TC, you're getting a collapse of the marginal Fermi liquid-like scattering. So you have a transition from some marginal Fermi liquid type of situation, and it's approaching a Lorentzian. And as Doug Vaughan and Walter Hardy's data has shown really beautifully, certainly below 60 Kelvin, you have a really nice Lorentzian. So we know that that's what's happening to the optical conductivity, that it's transitioning from this power law, marginal Fermi-like fractional power law, to something that's a simple Lorentzian. And what's happening is that the characteristic, the full width at half maximum, is not changing that much, but there's a tremendous change in the line shape, and that the condensate density that's appearing is coming from a very broad distribution of energies all the way up to this energy scale here. And recently, Jules Carbat and collaborators have linked this phenomenologically with the appearance of the sharp resonance in neutron scattering, and I certainly may well be that there is some link in that, but that's sort of a separate, somehow understanding and incorporating all of that would fit that criteria to be an ultimate test if you could explain, you know, what is happening as you condense. But certainly it seems not physically, but intuitively that somehow the collapse of this funny kind of scattering and the onset of conventional scattering, which is releasing all of this spectral weight into the condensate, has something to do with why this is a high temperature superconductor in some vague sense.
This is also true in the underdoped samples.
The underdoped samples are even more complicated because this feature, this gap-like feature, appears in the normal state. And that's something, yes.
Low energy is there at today peak.
But that's not true in ARPAs, right? In the underdoped samples, the sharpening of the quasiparticle bond occurred.
Well, yeah, but there's at
TC, not at TC.
Yeah, well, and that's why this sharpening that you're talking about. Yeah, I took out the
data. Where rho s comes from the underdoped samples, it still comes from some wide frequency range, or is there a Coulee peak?
Yeah. You see, what I was getting at, and I think this is something that I find really mysterious. So if I look at the data on the underdoped materials, then this gap-like feature appears above TC. So you might think, we thought maybe this is a fluctuation kind of superconductivity.
But does the line shape become more Lorentzian?
Well, we don't know. We just don't know. That's an open question. We don't know about that line shape. But one of the things we do know is that it's extremely unlikely that that revealing of this gap-like feature in the underdoped has anything to do with superconductivity, because another thing the UBC group has shown is that they get a sort of a miraculous scaling of this rho s curve when they go more underdoped. So apparently that sharpening of this feature and revealing of this gap in the underdoped seems to me to be unrelated to superconductivity. And this is something we look for in experiments I'm not talking about that we published a year ago or so, is that when we look in the below T star, where pseudo gap anomalies appear, we don't see any superfluid density at all, even a fluctuating superfluid density.
But there is no Drude peak, you said you don't know the Drude.
Drude peak where? Yeah, I don't know whether that line shape becomes. Certainly we know just from DC transport, you know, this pseudo gap anomaly in DC transport. I mean, so this is a very famous result that I'm sure you're familiar with. Right. So this is rho versus T, and this is optimal, and this is under. So at T star, I mean, what you can take to be T star, there's this undershoot of the conductivity. And the best samples, like the 1-2-4, the best underdoped samples, it appears almost that this is linear. So up here, it's marginal Fermi liquid-like. And that at T star, there is some reduction of scattering below that.
So the Druid peak has to sharpen.
The Druid peak is sharpening, but fairly subtly. I mean, the change in tau is only a factor of 2. I mean, by the time you get to TC, it is only the anomaly in the best samples is only about a factor of 2. So there's a factor of 2 sharpening of the conductivity. And we've worked hard to try to understand whether that sharpened peak is could be a condensate, a collective mode, the appearance of phase fluctuation superconductivity, or it's just the single particles are becoming less scattered.
What's the spectral weight under that peak?
Okay, so the question you're asking relates directly to this difficulty. This is exactly, remember I said there's a difficulty with the data. You're asking exactly in this region here, like half of the temperature, where it's very hard to measure. But the best indications are that the spectral weight is conserved. So it's a simple narrowing and sharpening of the Druid peak with conservation of spectral weight. So this, the model that many people have suggested, so that there's some sort of incoherent gap, maybe unrelated to superconductivity, that's gapping out certain excitations, leading to a reduction of scattering, is consistent. Another thing is consistent is that this whole picture, this whole region, is very unrelated to superconductivity.
Joe, I think when Dmitry Pazov was here, and maybe other people remember better than I, that he suggested that the spectral wave was sort of being rearranged over a large region in frequency, even, I think, above TC.
That is, that in the single gap regime, you're actually transferring weight to high energy. You're actually losing spectral weight at the lowest frequencies, as if the gap was opening up. But instead of going into a delta function because there's no superconductivity, it was going up to very high energies, and then somehow, when you went into the superconductor, it's a game like it rearranged. So you brought it back into the delta function.
Well, I know that the conductivity is going up,
yes.
Anomalously up. The resistivity is going down.
That's right.
AC.
Yeah. So now you want to argue that it's not only going up, but it's losing spectral weight.
You're losing spectral weight.
Yeah, because it's getting narrower.
More time on AB.
Well, I just...
Yeah, I think so.
I think those are. I'd like to see.
We'll all have to look on the web.
Okay.
See what he said precisely.
Joe, you seem to think it's very surprising that you get this gap-like feature showing up below TC. Showing up in the pseudogap state. But to me, if I were to take the Kubo formula that you wrote down before, mm-hmm. marginal Fermi liquid self-energy, mm-hmm. and arbitrarily just stuck a gap in there, a single part of the gap. That's exactly what you get.
Right.
So I don't see why it's so surprising.
Okay, that you see it above. Yeah, okay, here's what I find is, it's just that you form a gap. I would like to think, to keep my life simple, that that's the superconducting gap. So I sort of want the gap formation. If I see this, in an optimal sample, I see this, and the spectral weight goes to the condensate. So therefore, in the underdoped sample, when I see this, I want the spectral weight to go to the condensate. But of course, it doesn't go to the condensate because we know it's not a superconductor. So I was thinking maybe it would go into a quasi-delta function because it's a phase fluctuation superconductor. And that's what we seem to have ruled out, to the extent that you can ever rule anything out. But it seems like the evidence is against that. So I would say then, you're perhaps conserving. I really don't know if you're exactly conserving the spectral weight. That's the issue they brought up. I think it's overall. I'm saying whether it's moving here or some of it's, It's a pretty subtle question in the AB plane where the reflectivities are high and the characteristic frequencies are getting low.
But in the underdoped samples, one sees things at T star, you're saying this pseudo gap you start seeing in this sigma 1. Does anything dramatic happen as you hit TC besides, you're obviously going to have a delta, function.
Yeah.
But is there anything dramatic happening?
We find that this here, in our frequency regime, we find that this is very dramatic. We don't really know why. I could show you that.
But this is, sorry, this is under doped, optimally doped?
Yeah, under doped. So you want to look at the pseudo gap anomaly.
Well, the difference between the pseudo gap and the low TC and the under doped.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so. Now here's the.
Period,
wasn't it? Pardon? So, these are Zach's data. We saw the same thing earlier, but it was a twin crystal. So, in any case, these data are much prettier.
So which is the underdoped? Sorry.
So here's 93, 82, 56. Yeah. And it's hard to see, but the dashed line is the line at TC. Mm-hmm. So then you see that here, you know, especially if you look here at TC, there's quite a strong difference, right? I mean, in other words, here at TC, it's pretty smooth. Here, at even in this one, but especially here, you know, there's quite a pronounced feature. And my problem is that you see here, this is 90 and this is 80. So you see how rapid this drop is. And that's where the condensate spectral weight is coming from, predominantly in here. Now, this set of curves doesn't resemble this set of curves. So I'm a little confused about how the superfluid density can be so universal, where the high frequency regime, where that superfluid density is coming from, can be completely non-universal. So I think this is puzzling. And the only thing that it suggests to me is that this entire gap formation, which you alluded to, is certainly not a fluctuating superconducting gap. Because if this gap formation had to do with fluctuation superconductivity, above, then I would expect the rho S versus T curves to be very different, reflecting the difference between this set of spectra and that set of spectra.
Although, you know, it's not that universal. Or it's scaling with, like, X, right? So, you know, you're not piling up as much in the underdoped.
No, but I'm saying it's universal in the sense that if you take their data as listed on the...
Normalize it by X, but, you know, then...
No, normalize it, no. Plot rho S over rho 0 over T over... versus T over TC, they almost lie on top of each other. Not quite, but almost.
But TC is going down, T star is going up.
Yeah, same thing.
Yeah, yeah. So why do the curves, why are they, so they're so different. They exemplify different physics in this frequency range and exemplify the same exact physics in the superfluid density.
Don't you say that you don't know where the
Well, we know that this, one thing we do know is that this reduction, this spectral weight change here is not going to a delta function.
No, that's fine.
Above
TC.
Just
take the data above TC but below T star and compare it with the data below TC. Below TC, I had this condensate and the spectral weight for that condensate must have come from somewhere.
Right.
As they go below TC.
Right.
And you said, right now you don't know exactly where it comes from in the underdoped side.
Right.
TC plus 10 degrees and TC minus 10 degrees.
Yeah.
And that's, where does the, maybe rho S is sufficiently small, you just.
Does it come from the low frequency part above TC or does it come from all over?
It's coming from all over, I would say.
Even in the underdoped side.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Maybe we could.
Well,
I mean, it's determined by what probe. These are the spectra, so.
You now measure much below this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So is there any possibility that some of those curves cross when you go lower and recover spectral weight that way?
I can show you what we see. I was going to show, I think that Teague is definitely setting in.
Yeah,
in a profound way. This is these are our lower frequency data for BISCO. And there's one point I want to make about this. So this is optimal. This is underdoped. So let's look at underdoped first. So this underdoped sample has a T star of about 160 Kelvin. So this sample has a, it's probably not as clean as 124, but it has a resistivity anomaly that we associate with underdoped materials. That's at about 160. But you can see it's a pretty subtle effect. It's only about 30%. So when we look at low frequencies, we don't see any anomalous behavior at T star, as far as we can tell. But instead, we see certainly the a dramatic reduction of conductivity at about a terahertz. That's one. That's 30 wave numbers or so. This is where the spectral weight is coming from. So here you get a major drop of conductivity all of a sudden at a temperature well below T star. So the way it seems to me is that there is a well-defined mean field, if you like, temperature for underdoped materials that has nothing to do, or at least very much smaller than T star. So there's maybe some subtle spectral weight.
I see. Okay, so there's T star way up here.
Yeah.
There's TC way down here, and then there's some
mean field which is not that far above. Well, this sample is kind of interesting. This sample has this temperature here is about 50. Yeah. And actually, Van Harlingen's group, Kevin Osborne, has taken this same exact sample and done the rho S at very low frequency. And what you see is really nice Kosterlitz-Thallus step at about 32. So it seems that in this particular sample, there's some sort of mean field-like feature here at 45 or so, and that if you probe it at very low frequencies, you get a Kosterlitz-Thallus-like transition at about 30. So
what's coming from very low? So in the underdoped, the delta function is coming from very low frequencies.
I don't think so. I mean, because we don't know how. We can't go much higher. So
yeah.
I would say that, you know, if you look at twice this frequency, you would get a curve very, very much like this.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's just, yeah.
Okay. So that's just like Kosterlitz-Thallus, where the mean field temperature is twice the Kosterlitz-Thallus temperature, right?
I don't think so. That ratio, I think, is not.
Yeah, the Kosterlitz-Thallus temperature.
Now, that depends a lot on the slope of the bare superfluid density, but. Why does it say TC of 49? Because that's what we thought on the basis when we only had this set of data, and we thought that was TC. And then when we did the, I don't have that view graph, when you looked at the evolution of the dynamic superfluid density with frequency, you could see it has a tail that goes up to about 49. And then when you look at 80 kilohertz, it just shoots up at 32.
Yeah, maybe we should.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.